Both our Old Testament reading and the Gospel lesson this morning present stories of people who wanted to hold on to that special feeling, people who wanted to stay right where they were, people who wanted their mountaintop experience, if you will, to last on and on. In the Gospel lesson, Jesus takes Peter and James and John apart from the other disciples and up onto a mountain, where lo and behold, Jesus is transfigured before them, such that his clothes become a dazzling white, and Moses and Elijah also appear there with him, representing all of the authority of both the law and the prophets. And Peter and James and John are quite understandably startled by this experience. Now, who wouldn't be, to see these iconic heroes from Israel's history and to see Jesus quite literally in a whole new light? Peter, we're told, was so shaken by all this that he doesn't know quite what to do or to say. And so, in his fear and uncertainty, he brashly declares how good it is to be there. And then he offers to build 3 dwellings, one for Moses, one for Elijah, and one for Jesus, presumably so that they could all stay there together in some experience of unending glory. But then a cloud overshadows them, and God's voice is heard to say, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." And then, in another flash, Moses and Elijah are gone, the divine epiphany is over, and they are left alone again with Jesus, standing atop the now ordinary mountain, with the long climb down still ahead of them. Peter's actions in this story represent, I suppose, a not untypical response to situations that are mystifying or dazzling, situations so full of God's presence that we don't know quite what to make of them. Instead of simply being in the moment on the mountaintop and trying to discern what this experience might mean for them, Peter busies himself with trying to ensure that the experience itself doesn't end. Let's just bottle this up and bask in it forever. Our Old Testament reading offers us yet another story, but one with some striking similarities. In this morning's passage from 2 Kings, we have Elijah, the great prophet of Israel, and Elisha, his young protege, traveling together throughout the region in what's a bit like an episode from that TV show The Amazing Race, or perhaps even one of Cher's seemingly endless farewell tours. First, they journey from Gilgal to Bethel. Then they journey from Bethel to Jericho. And finally, they journey from Jericho to beyond the Jordan. And while both of these men seem to know that the time has come for Elijah to be taken up to heaven, the young Elisha doesn't seem quite ready to accept this reality. He tries to silence the other prophets when they speak about it. And 3 times, when the old man tries to go on ahead alone, the young Elisha protests, saying, "As the Lord lives, I will not leave you." Kind of like Peter's, "Let's build 3 dwellings." There was a part of Elisha that wanted desperately to hold on to things the way they were. He wanted to stay in that place, and he wanted to stay with Elijah. He wanted to stay with the one who had taught him and guided him, the one who had been a role model for him. But then there finally comes that moment when the older man knows that there's no time left. And so in a final question, he asks Elisha to tell him, "What can I do for you before I am taken from you?" And in a reply that's almost a desperate plea, Elisha asks, "Please let me inherit a double portion of your spirit." And Elijah responds, "It's a hard thing that you've asked, but if you see me as I'm being taken from you, it will be granted." And then, quite fittingly, on this first weekend of the Olympic Winter Games, as I can almost hear the theme music from that iconic Olympic movie playing in the background, chariots of fire appear in the sky. And the young Elisha watches in awe and wonder as he does see Elijah lifted up from him in a fiery whirlwind, a bit like the launch of Elon Musk's latest SpaceX rocket, one might imagine, but surely not. This mystically charged moment of prophetic torch passing has sometimes been referred to as the transfiguration of Elijah. But more importantly, is that we also see a transformation of Elisha in this story as well. Because in this powerful moment, things were changed for him forever. And Elisha had to come down from that mountaintop. Not a literal mountaintop, maybe, but down from that mountaintop experience. Because the time had come for him to take up the role for which his mentor had long prepared him. The time had come for Elisha to become the prophet of Israel that God was calling him to be. And in the verses that follow today's reading, we're told that Elisha does pick up the mantle that's left for him by Elijah as he ascends in the whirlwind. And Elisha uses his master's cloak in the same way that Elijah had used it to part again the waters of the Jordan in an exodus-like fashion. And then Elisha moves back across the river in order to begin to carry out his prophetic work in the world. We've all had the experience of wanting to stay put, to stay exactly where we were. We've all found places of rest and recharging, places where we feel close to God and where we feel comforted and at home spiritually. Like Elisha, we've all found people in our lives in whose fellowship we experience the presence of God. And like Peter, we too desire at times to just dwell in the glory of the living Christ, even as overwhelming as that glory can sometimes be. But none of these proverbial mountaintop moments is meant to be an end in itself, because every experience of holy insight, whether it's inspired by beautiful worship or intellectual discovery, whether it's inspired by an ecstatic vision or by artistic splendor, whether it's inspired by moments of profound fellowship or of deep intimacy, every mountaintop moment should lead us to the question, so what? Now that we've been gifted with this moment, now that we've been blessed by this insight or this experience, how does it change us? How does it transfigure us? And where does it lead it? How does it strengthen us to live out our response, not on the mountaintop, but down in the valleys of life, where Christ leads us and calls us to follow? Because we're not called to stay on the mountaintop. Rather, we're called to wade into life in all its messiness. We're called to ask hard questions and to share deep compassion. We are called to discover how we, as people of faith, can best respond to and care for God's world in which we live. Because to engage life deeply and with passion, that's the real work that God calls us to. And while I do believe that the transfiguration stories that we read about this morning point to the glory of God and to the heaven that awaits us, their main message, for me at least, is far more about learning to see God's glory as it comes to us in the everyday here and now. It would be nice, perhaps, if the Olympic podium could be achieved and maintained without the rigors of Olympic training. It would be nice if life could be all pub nights and no vestry meetings, all spirited worship without the faith-filled work and witness that our worship is meant to inspire. If life could be all Easter with no Good Friday. But while God gives us the mountaintops to recharge us and replenish us, to comfort us and to speak clearly to us, God calls us primarily to work not on the mountains, but in the valleys and plains, in the everyday places of our everyday life. And so today we receive the gift of seeing Christ transfigured, decked out in dazzling white, and God's voice clearly speaking to us from the mountain. But in the week that lies ahead, we must come down from that mountain into the valley, and we must begin again the long and challenging journey with Jesus toward Jerusalem, to his cross, to his death, to his grave, and beyond. And our challenge on this Transfiguration Sunday, and on the journey that lays before us, is to learn to show God's love. To learn to show God's glory in our words and actions, because we are called to to touch people's lives with the light of God shining through us, a light that can transfigure each and every one of us, a light that working through us can help to transform God's world. And so as we prepare for our Lenten journey, it's my earnest prayer that our own vision would be transformed, such that we would strive to see all God's people as God sees them, that our insight would be transformed such that we would grow to be ourselves and to see ourselves as God created us to be. And finally, that our lives would be transformed such that we would learn to live always by the Spirit, who dwells continually within us and amongst us, and who gives us the strength for this and for every journey. Amen.